How's your car looking? Showing its age? Faded paint? Dents? Dings? Don't worry. Maaco is here to help. They're the experts in affordable paint jobs and light collision repairs, helping you keep your car looking its best without breaking the bank. With Maaco's national reach and community focus, you're not just getting top-notch service. You're actually getting a partner you can trust. Visit your local Maaco today and see how they can refresh your ride. Go in, get the free estimate, and the expert technicians will handle the rest. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break Podcast, a real conversation about finance.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone.
I feel like sometimes being broke is a cycle and that we might have to revisit that.
And we're not stopping at success stories.
What happens when it doesn't go right? How do you cope with it?
Because wealth isn't just about money. It's about creating a life where you thrive and help others do the same.
Listen to the Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Oh, it just keeps getting more and more interesting. The trial of Karen Reed. Here we are into week number three. And Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, is here to discuss it with us. But before we start talking, Jennifer, of course we have to do this. We have to thank our sponsor again today, Karen Reed Vodka. Karen Reed Vodka, where memory fails, confidence prevails. Karen Reed Vodka. It's always good to have a supporter on the program. So, where do we begin with all of this? Last week, we saw a lot of people taking the stand. Jen McCabe, of course, I think the star of the week. Let's start out there. Let's start out with her testimony. Let's start out with the prosecution and how that was walked through. I felt it was really painting an emotional picture far better than what we saw in trial number one with Lally. I think he really laid it out well. What was your reaction to that portion of the questioning?
Well, I agree, Tony. And the number one thing he did to start off that wasn't done last year, he made Jen McCabe come alive.
Mm-hmm.
Mother of four daughters, a coach, a prior teacher, somebody who had a life and a very busy life, and somebody that it didn't make any sense would all of a sudden be caught up in a huge murder plot,
mm-hmm.
and be coordinating witnesses and making sure things happened in a certain way. I mean, I think many people could relate to Jen McCabe as, you know, the mom next door.
Yeah.
The coach that coaches your kids and somebody that you really like. Mm-hmm. on the stand, and she looked a lot different, to yeah. be honest.
Mm-hmm.
She lightened up her hair.
Yeah. I think she was more comfortable too. I think, you know, she's been through this ringer so many times now. It's not, she wasn't tense. She was, I think, just kind of over it, really. Just like, here's the reality, kids, whether you like it or not. And a lot of people did not like those little pieces of reality there. Let's talk about, the other side of this. I don't know where to go with it because I see the comments of, and where Jackson was trying to go with this too, of she's lying, she's being untruthful. I'm still trying to understand about what, and what are they trying to say? Where are they trying to say it? Because it seems they're arguing a lot of semantics that really don't have a whole lot to do with the case. Can you bring up anything that you can argue where they're saying this is not true? What's your rebuttal to that?
Yeah, let me go through a few of them, the ones that they really highlighted. Mm-hmm. One of them was whether she had lied to the FBI, to the grand jury, mm-hmm. about the "I hit him" statement, right? Because there were semantics, as you said. Was it really "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him"? Or was it she started talking about whether she had hit him? And so part of that, she tried to explain to Jackson and the jury that, listen, it depends on exactly what I'm asked. And I always wonder, just think how few people, Tony, have ever been on the stand and been grilled, have ever been in a grand jury room mm-hmm. and been a witness. It's just so, you know, minuscule how many people ever do it. And it's so hard. You're sitting there looking at, you know, over a dozen people. They're grilling you. They're asking you questions. Yes, the prosecutor is asking you questions and there's no defense on the other side. But you can imagine what the people in the grand jury, they get asked questions of you. Mm-hmm. They get a dial down. They get a drill in. Yeah. And it's very formal. And it's, you know, hard, especially for somebody who has never testified before. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you on the stand. She was so confident and she was so comfortable. But that was one of the points they tried to make. Well, you didn't say three times like you're saying here. Mm-hmm. And then she explained, right, Tony? She said, listen, the more you think about it, the more particulars you're asking me about, I'm going to give them to you. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the words I recall. Mm-hmm. And so I think she did a great job handling it.
And I find it interesting that they're still sticking on this point, because Karen Reed herself has even said, I know I said I hit him. Like, that's her literal sentence. I know I said I hit him. And then she also has said many times of the variations of everything she was saying. So it's, to me, this is not like an out there thought that she would have exclaimed these things. And it doesn't necessarily make it a confession, but it makes it part of this cornucopia of chaos that was going on in that moment of time where she's trying to figure out what the hell happened. Maybe it was somewhat confessional on her part. I don't know. But the words uttered out of her mouth, whether Jackson likes that or not, by Karen's own admission after the fact, why are we still on this? Because all it takes is someone to press play on a clip, and there she is saying, I know I said I hit him. Why are we drilling on this? I don't seem to think that this is helping the defense of Karen Reed in any way. I feel like Jackson put her back up on the stand, Jen McCabe, and Jen McCabe just had a second opportunity to reiterate everything she just said to the prosecution to drill it in even harder to the jury.
No, you're exactly right. What case, I can't think of one, have we seen the prosecution's witnesses corroborated by the defendant?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you have here. You have McCabe saying she said it, and then they play the clip. It's that 10-second long clip where she says, and she's laughing and being silly to ID Discovery. She says, well, I know I said I hit him, but did I really say it as many times as they said I said it? And it just is something that I don't think any jury can possibly overlook. And it corroborated Jim McCabe.
It completely did. And they know that material is there. Is Alan Jackson just going out there seeing what sticks? Like, I'm going to argue this really hard, despite the fact that there's overwhelming evidence that's going to contradict everything I just said, and hope the jury remembers more of me saying it than them hearing this over here. I'm wondering if that's the strategy at this point, because they seem to be kind of up against a wall.
Well, his strategy is he tries to really drown out the witness.
Mm-hmm.
I bet if you took the exact number of minutes and hours, maybe, that Jim McCabe spoke, it would be 1/8 of the words that Alan Jackson spoke.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he floods. He goes on these filibusters. There's not even really a question. She had to warn, meaning the judge had to warn him multiple times, stop with the comments, stop with the comments, mm-hmm. because it becomes his testimony.
Yeah.
And that's what he's hoping for, that everybody will remember his testimony, not her answer.
Yeah, I mean, he's playing fast and loose with the rules because I think he knows he can. And he's going just far enough where it's not going to be something that's going to harm him or Karen in his view, but enough to get some statements out to the jury. And of course, you know, disregard that jurors, but it's out there. It's out there. People have heard what they've heard. And it seems that he's doing a lot of that. I don't know how effective it's going to be this round. Again, it felt very much like it was arguing a lot of weird semantics on the part of Karen Reed. The other piece that I'm trying to wrap my mind around and try to understand where they're coming from, it was Karen arguing it outside of court, I believe Friday of the second week, where it's something about the accountability of Jen McCabe. She's the one who called 911. I'm not quite sure what Karen is trying to argue, that Jen didn't care about him and no one else called 911. It didn't make a lot of sense compared to what reality was. Can you shine any light on where they're trying to go with that argument of Jen not caring about the well-being of John O'Keefe in those moments?
Yeah, it was really something. So she's the only one who does call 911.
Mm-hmm.
They try to point out that she said there's a man on the lawn,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, crying and being hysterical. But I think we can tell by the way she testifies and by what she says, she is not one to get rattled.
No.
And her explanation was, listen, I was trying to get forth information.
Yeah.
So I don't need to say it's John O'Keefe. And can you imagine many people would do that. She did it perfectly.
Yeah.
There's a man on the lawn. This is what I know. This is the situation. And she did it great. And I think that's from her background being a coach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're coaching in a basketball game and things are getting hairy and sticky, yeah. you never want to come unraveled. She's just a very together woman,
yeah.
and they tried to extrapolate from her controlled, words to 911 that she somehow didn't care. It made no sense.
Oh my God. She was the grown-up in the room. She was the one that was calm. So they're arguing because she wasn't hysterical like Karen Reed was, that somehow is a fault to her because she was calmly communicating what needed to be done in an emergency. That's the type of person you want in an emergency.
Right. At least she didn't say there was a buffalo on the lawn.
Oh my God. He's like
Karen
a buffalo.
Said, right?
Yeah. He's like a buffalo.
Yeah. Literally.
I saw that and I saw Alan Jackson and he just kind of, you can tell when he's kind of cringing, but not saying it out loud and not really trying to show it. But you can tell he's kind of feeling it like, Jesus, how dumb is she? Like, what is she going to say? Why are they letting her talk? Why is he not just being like, let's move on, Karen? Because every single day, they already got all the clips. They already got all the interviews that are out there that are damning her. Why are they letting her continue to talk? None of this is helping her case.
No, I agree. And in one day, they wouldn't let her talk, I don't think. I mean, she didn't talk. And I said, oh, finally, they've muzzled her. Smart, you know? And then sure enough, the next day, she cannot help herself.
No.
She thinks so much of herself.
Yeah.
And she thinks that everybody thinks so much of her that she can convince anyone of anything. And that's why she did all these documentaries. Mm-hmm. This is all about her and aggrandizing herself. It's really something. I did want to bring up, though, another point that they tried to bring out that I thought was Alan Jackson's biggest mistake of his entire cross.
Mm-hmm.
He's needling her. He's clapping his hands. You know, why didn't your sister come out? Why didn't they come out?
Mm-hmm.
Why weren't you afraid? This is the worst cross I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
Why weren't you afraid for your sister that was in the house when there's a murdered man or a dead man out on the lawn? And it was perfect. It was like putting a huge tennis ball on a golf tee.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim McCabe says, Well, because there was a broken taillight. Karen Reed was screaming she hit him. And basically, I wasn't worried about anything inside the house. I was worried about what happened out here. Where's that affected? She kind of goes through the case in small, short version. And Alan Jackson realizes it, tries to interrupt her, but she's able to finish her answer. And I thought that was a really big moment for Alan Jackson failing.
I wonder if Alan is having any regrets yet. Like, got a lot of publicity on this one, but I don't know that it's like landing very well. I mean, came across a lot stronger on the first trial. This one's like, yeah, maybe this isn't the one you want to hang your hat on. I don't know. It's getting to be quite the spectacle. I want to go through the timeline of events, and we've all heard them 1,000 times. You laid out a pretty good list the other day on your Twitter or X, going through piece by piece of what occurred that day leading up to the death of John O'Keefe. And I know everybody likes to argue about this point and that point, so I just want to go through it and let's discuss all of it. And I'll shoot you any questions I can think of, whether they're mine or just, you know, questions I know that are out there. And let's walk through this. This is from you the other day. From the evidence below is what happened to John O'Keefe. Karen Reed had fought with John all day via texts and their relationship, and we've seen those texts. John finally agreed to get together via text. Reed joins him late. We see that on video. Reed and John are both outwardly getting along, as of course we've seen as well. Reed and John are drinking excessively. Yes, of course we've seen that too, and the BAC information backs that up. Reed and John are invited to Brian Albert's house, friend of John, although not a close friend, to have a drink and celebrate Brian's son's birthday. Let's first stop there for a moment and talk about the relationship that John O'Keefe had with the people at that home, at that small gathering, because a lot of people are going to say they barely knew each other. I'm going to let you step in there and explain that.
Well, it's more extended than that, right? Mm-hmm. They were both Boston police officers. Yeah. So of course they had a relationship. They're both living in Canton. Of course they know each other and they run in similar circles. Jen McCabe is the sister-in-law of Brian Albert, and Jen McCabe and John O'Keefe were very close. Their children were close, and that's what brought them together, right? Yeah. So certainly they knew each other, even though he hadn't been to that house. They weren't partiers together. They weren't that tight, but they knew each other, and certainly well enough to get the extended invite. Hey, come on, we're not done drinking. My son's having, I believe it was his 22nd birthday. Come join us. There's just a few of us getting together. I think literally 11 people. This was not a blowout party.
No. And that's a very normal thing. If anybody who has been in any sort of cultures like that, you end up at a bar, you end up with a bunch of friends or even acquaintances, and you hang out throughout the night, which they did, and like, yeah, come on over. We're going to get, okay, even if you know one or two people, that's usually how that begins, because you're invited over, and then this is a party-type crowd. This is a warm crowd. This is a family, friends crowd. Let's hang out. Let's talk. Let's drink. I get it. So nothing of that seems weird to me. I've seen some arguments about it being, you know, obviously it's the birthday party going on. And I've seen arguments going, well, it's for, he was a, how old was the birthday boy in this?
Do 22, I believe, from turning 21 to 22.
Sure.
But when you see him in the first trial, we got to see him, Tony.
Yeah.
This is a very subdued, very quiet, mannered young man. He's not a partier. He wasn't even out drinking on his big night.
Yeah.
He was just wanting to gather with a few friends. He's that type of personality. And we all have no friends and people and, and children. One of my children is like that.
Yeah.
They don't want to go out. They don't party at all. They're at home and they want just their small nest of friends. That is how he comes off.
Sure. So they go back and they are at the house and they have a get together. The end of the bar time. It's the after party, but it's a low key after party. John and Karen, this is from your post, John and Karen drive there. But on the way, they get turned around, perhaps because they're both drunk. And I agree. And Jen McKay, Brian's sister-in-law, helps give directions. And John and Karen but mentions the name of John's past girlfriends, whose house is near, as a landmark. And this is from the cell phone data and testimony, correct? That is mentioned there.
Yes, not only is it mentioned, but actually they played clips, two clips, of Karen Reed talking about that.
Yeah.
And I didn't put that in the post. I probably should have, but I did later kind of comment about it. So Karen Reed herself is saying, see, he basically right before my relationship, he went to bed with her. Mm-hmm. He says the words "hooked up with her," I think were her exact words. Mm-hmm. And she lived right down the street. And, you know, when she's talking about all of, you know, where could he be? And so you can see her bring it to light.
Yeah.
And they got to play that.
I thought it was interesting how she worded it too, because Karen's, he recently, I think is what she said, the word recently had been with her. It's like, you mean like 2 years ago before you met him? Like, that's not recently. Recently is like last week or last month. That's not recent, Karen. But it speaks to Karen's mindset, though, and paranoia about any other women around John O'Keefe and personality types like this. This is one of their kryptonites. It's this fear of being left. It's this insecurity that someone else is going to be with your man. And any woman, I mean, she'd probably freak out if it was someone from high school. That would be recent to her, too. Like, when he was 18, he slept with her. That was recent. Like, no, it's not, Karen. That's a long time ago. But that paranoia level is interesting. And I just think it's a piece of the puzzle. It's a stone in the making of all this to try and understand Karen Reed. So Reed then loses it, and they start fighting. Reed is jealous and doesn't want him around other women. This is from the text and the testimony. John leaves the car, grabs his glass, and has his glass, evidence of the glass at the scene, and Reed's statement and testimony. Reed's jealous and boiling angry that John doesn't want to be with her and would rather go to the party with people he doesn't know well. That's from Reed's statements. Do you think that was going through John's mind at the time? Do you think it's, I don't know these people well, or just, I'm done arguing with you, Karen. I'm going to get out of this car. And she knows McCabe's there. She knows some other people that, or he knows some other people there. Just, you know, okay, I'm done with this. I just need to get out.
I think it was, I need to get out. I'm done. And I also think that part of the reason that Karen Reed might not have wanted to go in was the fact that, Brian Higgins was there.
Mm-hmm.
She sees the truck. She sees the plow. She knows he decided to go right at the bar. Nobody ever really knows who's going, right?
Yeah.
Because of his invitations. Like, yeah, just come back to the house. Everybody's like, oh, yeah, we'll be there. Some people go, some people don't. And I think that, remember, at this time, she was courting him.
Yeah.
She'd reached out to him. They were having this. And I think that situation might have made her feel somewhat uncomfortable. I think she was very jealous. And I'm not so sure, judging by all of those buildup texts from earlier in the day, that you never know if the actual breakup, if you will, occurred right then.
Mm-hmm.
How I did that tweet was very specific, exactly what I did when I would go to a prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say, here's a fact, and here are the two or three points of evidence we have to support it.
Yeah.
And then I would hook it up on the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's how I did this. So I didn't want to put that in because we haven't heard about a breakup.
Yeah.
So that part of it is just sort of possible.
Sure. Sure. It's in another interesting dynamic there. She's so paranoid about John cheating on her with the neighbors that he hasn't seen in forever. Yet she's actively courting another guy, actively inviting him to come over and sleep with her because they're both adults. And she's projecting all this out there and reversing it around as someone with a narcissistic personality. And she seems to have that, does. I mean, obviously it's not breaking the law, but it's really just kind of amazing how the rules don't apply to her. They apply to everyone else, including John O'Keefe, but her, you know, it's this or that, as we've heard Karen say before, you know, well, you know, they should have been, not witnesses. They should have been suspects. But it's like she has that same outlook there on her sexual life as well, with John O'Keefe, that she can go do whatever. And John, you know, it's the end of the world if he were to look at another woman.
Well, you know, at the root of people who are narcissistic, at the very root is their own self-contempt.
Mm-hmm.
Really, like if you could just peel everything back, it's their own self-doubt, self-contempt. I mean, really at the root of it. And then that's why it's exacerbated with, I'm great, I'm wonderful, I can do no wrong. That's how they overcome that. And you see that with her.
You do.
Right? It's so crystal clear. Mm-hmm. That the rules for everybody else don't apply to her.
She's a lesson in this. Okay, so this is a big point here. She throws the SUV in reverse, and you put meaning to hit him, but not kill him. In her drunken state, her judgment is a hot mess. She wants to hurt him because she's angry and hurt. So we have the vehicle, we have phone data, and we have Reed's own statements. How are you getting to that she means to hit him? How do you show intent there on that piece, in your opinion?
In my opinion, how you show it is, number one, purposefully throwing a car in reverse that doesn't need to go into reverse. She needs to go forward. Number two, accelerating, pressing on that accelerating and accelerating up to 24 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who has gone in reverse, 24 miles an hour.
It's a lot.
Like, it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's not slow. It's a lot to even control your vehicle. So that's number two. Number three, we have the voicemail messages that were made shortly after. They're also going to show the litany of unanswered calls and of text messages. I think it was 50, on the heels of this, to just show somebody unhinged, right?
Yeah.
And then we also know that then we are going to have the information from the car data, I believe, that's going to show that she hit something and that she was obstructed, or that it tried to stop her, right? This vehicle has, one of the vehicles we have has it.
Yeah.
Your vehicle might have it, Tony.
Yeah, it does.
Where it warns you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a part, even when you park, beep, 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 you're getting too close, right? Yeah. Or you go in reverse. Or even when you're driving, it'll beep, beep, beep. You're too close to that car.
I go in my garage. It does. Because my house is clean and my garage is like hoarders. Because it's all
really?
These Amazon boxes is what it is. It's empty Amazon boxes. Because I can't fit enough in my trash can every week. So they pile up. So my car alerts me there's Amazon boxes in my garage. But yes, to your point, yes, it senses that without a doubt. I want to talk about that car data because we haven't heard it come out in court yet. We know it's going to be showing, and that's going to be very interesting. And we had kind of some car data in the first one, but we didn't have anything that says the car shows an impact or shows a warning signal or anything like we're just talking about here. Are we going to get that? Do we know that data exists, that we're going to see that come up in court? Because if that shows that, that's going to be a hard one to get over.
Right. That's what they're indicating.
Mm-hmm.
The initial time they didn't have the right extraction done, for somebody who knew everything about Lexuses. Now we do. And remember another critical key, I think, that's an indication about Karen. All of a sudden, and you and I have talked about this, we hear about you two.
Mm-hmm.
We hear about this music blaring because that's how she always is.
Yeah.
I think that has specifically to do with why the defense is going to say she didn't hear it.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't hear the warning beep. She didn't hear anything. It was blaring. Well, if you're in a discussion or an argument with somebody, would you really have your music blaring? Typically, you're going to turn it down so everybody, they can hear you can hear them. So I think this was a ruse. We didn't hear about it the first go around, and now all of a sudden we're hearing about YouTube blaring. I think it's going to be because of this new vehicle data they know about.
They're trying to get ahead of it. I see what you're saying. Yeah. What about the argument here? What about, because again, it was odd that you're going that fast in reverse. Could one argue that she didn't realize it was in reverse in her drunken state and was ready to leave, and she slams on it thinking she's going to go forward, and whoops, goes back and hits John, not intentionally, but hits John and realizes she hits John. Could that be another argument here that it wasn't intentional, but she did in fact do it?
I mean, you could try to argue that, that they were either in the park position or, but my understanding is it was park to drive to reverse to drive. But I do agree with you. That's going to be important, but you know, this is her vehicle. It's not somebody else's, you know, familiarity. And then, you know, it's something the defense can always argue. I don't think I would buy it, but I'd be willing to listen to the discussion.
I mean, it seems like it could be plausible in this scenario, but I mean, you have a lot of other things where you get to the point now you're arguing someone's mindset. And she wasn't in a good one at that moment in time. Even in a sober state, it would not be a good mindset, but then you add all the liquor in there too. I don't know. She knows she hit him, but thinks he'll get up. He's tough after all. He's big and strong. She only clipped him. And of course she said that. Maybe I clipped him. He didn't look mortally wounded. Another statement that she said. Then Reed drives away. Reed statement, vehicle data, and cell data all back up those statements. And this is where it gets interesting. Reed returns or later returns to see if he ever got up. Reed is starting to worry because John's not home. She drives by and sees him still there waiting on the car data, which we're waiting on to see if there's data that shows this. She calls Carrie Roberts at 5 a.m. sharp screaming, John is dead. Of course, testimony does back that up. But what about this return to the scene? Do we have the data on that yet? That she left the scene and then drove by again? I mean, I've heard this. I've seen this. Clear that up for me, Jen.
Yeah. So I, again, this is my opinion of the order of events and what happened. I think that that is how she made the conclusion that she ended up telling Carrie he's dead. And I think that's also why she knew exactly where to look for the body. I think this is why she was so completely panicked. I just can't buy that she would have been this completely panicked if she hadn't seen his body. Was it on a drive back by? That is why I wrote, we're waiting to see that. But was it merely because she actually looked and saw him after the hit and would have felt it, by the way, on a vehicle? I mean, you feel it when you run over a squirrel. This was a 6 foot two guy that she would have clipped. And we see a big dent on the back of her car. You know, where the impact was, and a broken taillight. So there's no way she wouldn't have known, in my opinion. But did she check on him? That's one piece I do want to see.
And that's a piece that the we don't have the car data yet showing that. Are we expecting to see that? Because that is still up in the air of if she, in fact, did do a drive-by to check on seeing if John was there. And I'm sure they'll argue another thing if maybe she thought she'd go to the party later or something. That if, in fact, we have data that shows that, but we're not there yet. We don't necessarily have data, though, that shows that she did do a drive-by yet, correct?
Correct. Okay. We don't have it yet, but we'll see if it comes in. And that's why I did put that caveat there.
Okay. Reed also calls Jen McCabe frantic, talking about her broken taillight and hitting him. Of course, we've heard that. Those calls, testimony, Reed's statement, physical evidence, and the video of the taillight and the cell data. They drove by the house where John was dead in a driving blizzard, and somehow Reed sees him and jumps out, pulls his shirt up, lays on him, and she does not call 911. This is another interesting piece. This is another piece where Alan Jackson was getting pretty testy with Jen McCabe the other day about it. And I thought this was ridiculous because it seemed they were going on in semantics for about a half hour of, well, you got out of the car and you saw him. Basically, it was arguing in one testimony. She said she saw him when she got out of the car, or versus she got out of the car, walked towards where Karen was, and then saw him. The walking towards part doesn't seem to matter to me or anyone because it doesn't, it just doesn't matter. If you're reiterating the story to anybody, you may say you walked towards, you may say you're not. It's kind of implied saying you got out of the car and headed that way and then you saw him. I don't see anything weird or incriminating about that statement, but it seems Alan Jackson was trying to go on that.
Yeah, he was trying to say, again, fault her for not making a quicker 911 call. In other words, you saw it. You were by the car. Why didn't you call right then?
She didn't know yet.
Well, never saw the face by then. And this is what's amazing to me. I don't know if you remember earlier on, and I need to find this clip and I'll post it. But Karen Reed had always said, it was me who gave him CPR. I was the only one. And she makes a statement like that. I was the only one. Now we know that all three gave CPR. Jim McCabe gave CPR and Carrie Roberts. And that was all, again, her trying to aggrandize herself.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone who's been in this situation, and it reminded me of a crazy situation. I was driving to a tennis match. Mm-hmm. I stopped to get an energy drink and at this Quick Trip. And there was a guy, very thin build, you know, 40-year-old man, maybe. And I said, hey, I'm just going to run to the cabinet and get a thing, because he was working in the aisle. And then I went to go pay and he wasn't there. And I'm like, sir, because I was in a big hurry. It was early in the morning. I said, I'm just leaving the $3 here. And then I go to leave. And as I stare out the window in the reflection, he was on the ground, foaming at the mouth.
Oh, God.
Obviously. Jump over the counter at the Hanks was the name of it. Jump over the counter, immediately wiped the foam off of his mouth. And I know compressions are most important, but because he was foaming, I felt he needed breaths. I gave him 2 breaths and started CPR. Meanwhile, nobody else is there. I'm trying to call 911.
Mm-hmm.
I stop for a quick second, grab my phone. I'm dialing 911, pressing with one hand. It's a hectic, hot mess. Trying to get, you know, give CPR plus say what I'm saying. My point is, unless a person is in this type of situation, Tony, it is so hectic. And your first response is always to go to the person.
Yeah.
It's not to, I'm just going to call 911.
No.
You're going to evaluate.
Yeah.
Because how can you even relay information? Is he bleeding? Did he fall? You know, does he have a pulse? All that you need to evaluate first. And that's what I felt like all the ladies did.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't to call 911. And for him to make a deal out of that was really just shows me how little Alan Jackson has any understanding of an emergency situation.
Yeah, I mean, it really did not read well to anybody, I think. Anybody who's ever been in, and I'm sure there's at least a couple in that jury box that have been in a situation where there's a crisis. And it is a crisis for a reason. It's chaotic. It's why it's a crisis. And there isn't a perfect answer to anything at that moment. And of course, if you have the ability to help someone in that moment, you're the one there. Getting on the phone is not going to be the quickest way to help that person. But she did get on the phone, I think, relatively quickly for the situation. Once she realized what was going on, once there was someone that was assisting John as best they could, she found that open window to call 911 as quickly as she could. To argue the semantics of it just seem just ridiculous and kind of just heartless as well. It's very bizarre to me. another weird note as we're talking about this, when you're in that moment, you're like, okay, what do I do? Do I go down and help? Do I call 911? I'm honestly, and I'm saying this kind of tongue in cheek, surprised Karen, being as grandiose as she is, and how she likes to have everybody kind of look at her as a victim, I'm surprised she didn't get out her cell phone and was like, see, John left me. He's in the snow dying. He's a horrible boy. You know, I'm kind of surprised that didn't happen in a certain way. As people now we see half the time don't help, and it's just they're taking video of the situation. Yeah, I could see that being an option for her. But obviously, that's not what took place. So Reed, then she has her breakdown. And let's talk about getting to that for a moment, because I thought it was really great how they presented the timeline of this. Because in the previous trial, and just even in analyzing the case, I think a lot of times you get the impression that she's screaming the, I hit him, or did I hit him, and could I have hit him, at that moment when they're with the body, which makes sense why someone would be reacting that way. But she's doing this before there's even a body in the snow, or that they know there's a body in the snow. And Jen McCabe's not freaking out. She doesn't think that. Carrie Roberts is saying, why would you say that? Why would you think you hit him? No, you didn't. Let's go figure this out. Nobody else is thinking this. And of course, people are going to argue, well, because they know it, because those moms went out there and drug him out to the curb by the flagpole and then looked at basketball scores and went to bed. Yeah, that makes sense. But the fact that she's so early on going on and frantic about all of this just doesn't make any logical sense to me either. The night before, she's freaking out, thinking he's sleeping with somebody else. And that's usually her big fear. Why is she not going to that? Why is it not all about him sleeping with somebody? We get one little mention of she's curious about the Bella's mom down the road. But that's it. The rest is... She's afraid that he's dead in the snow or a snowplow hit him. If she saw him go into the house, which she's already testified to, why on earth would you think he's in the snow or a snowplow hit him?
Exactly. The whole thing makes no sense. If you really left your boyfriend at the party, mm-hmm. and remember, this is the other big point I want to bring up.
Yeah.
She said on Dateline, she watched him walk to the door, open it and stick his head in. That is a quote from Karen Reed.
Mm-hmm.
If you thought that, where do you get then later that you hit him at all? Well, what I think could have happened in all those different recitations of she hit him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And why on scene would you be hitting him? And I say it's because that is all a lie, a fabrication, it's contrived. She never thought that. And that's why you're concerned. Your tail light's broken. And yeah. She knew. I mean, I know a lot of people say she was backed out drunk. She really doesn't know. She's still trying to figure it out. Some people say that, mm-hmm. think that. Some people think that these were suggestions made to her, which is absolutely ludicrous. Because as you point out, she was telling Carrie Reed at 5 a.m. he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
How would you get from, I go home from a party, I leave him there after a fight, and he's dead on the side of the road?
Exactly.
How does anyone go to that unless you know you hit him and he's likely laying there dead, or you drove back by?
And the story changes when she realizes that Jen McCabe saw her vehicle outside the house. That's a part that's kind of spooky to me, because that shows... either another memory popped into her head at that moment and she's like, oh shit, yeah, I was there. Or it was, oh shit, the story I've been concocting for the last several hours doesn't add up. And I can't go with that because they saw me there. Shit. And she's already kind of concocting this thing early on. Do you think she was concocting this that early on? Or do you think it was just the drunkenness and... Okay, now I do remember that part. And then maybe more of that came back to her. I don't know. That's kind of a weird area, and you're trying to get into someone's head.
For me, she concocted it after the voicemail messages,
mm-hmm.
when she realized he didn't come home again. Either she did a drive-by or everything's coming in mm-hmm. clear. I mean, we know from that pulse talk, from the toxicology regarding her blood alcohol, that she could have been, I believe, 2.9 something.
It's up there. I mean, it's like 2 point something, yeah.
This is getting too lethal.
Yeah.
It's getting to, I mean, this is blackout drunk range. Now, remember, there was a range from, I think, 1.4 to the 2.9-ish, something like that. But, wow, that's just super drunk. And, you know, she's getting de-pickled mm-hmm. Throughout the night a little bit. And certainly things are going to be coming in clear. And obviously, to me, by 5 a.m., which is well before they found him, she knew in her mind he was dead because she said it.
Yeah. Yeah. An argument I'm surprised Karen Reed has not made, because when you look back at the toxicology and go, okay, here's the range that she would have been in at this hour, she should have argued that she kept drinking at home. She should have just said, I was stressed. I didn't know where John was. I had a couple more vodka tonics at home. And that's why my BAC was that level in the morning. It would make her look a little better in a bad situation, but not good.
And that's what Yannetti tried to do today with the toxicologist, or I should say the forensic analyzer of the BAC.
Yeah.
He tried to say that, but you don't know what she drank. You don't. But the problem is Karen Reed herself never said that, to your point.
Yeah.
She says she went home, she went to bed, you know, she was worried. And so, you know, that's a big problem, because now they're just bringing this up. I think the other big problem is Yannetti early on. And I posted that clip. I don't know if you had a chance to see it, mm-hmm. where Yannetti is arguing to the court. Listen, this isn't manslaughter. This was just an accident. She loved this man and all of that. Remember, that was the initial posture, because they had talked about it, client to attorney, and said she was freaking out. And she talks about it on ID. She specifically says, Yannetti, what happens if I did hit him? And Yannetti says, well, you could be in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And then that's where the spin, that's where it all changes.
It is. It is. And because then she immediately goes from really contemplating seriously that she could have hit him. And then somehow she just turns. It's like, then suddenly that's when I know I didn't hit him. Why? Because you're going to be accountable or because you didn't hit him? But it's like in the same sentence, this is her reasoning of like, well, I could be to blame, then I couldn't have done it. And she just speaks this aloud as if we're all going to keep playing the Karen Reed game with her. But in her mind, it makes total sense, because she can't be accountable for anything. I would love, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so sorry.
No, go ahead.
She says in that ID discovery, she says, I don't care whether it's one day in jail or years in jail. Quote, it's all the same to me. Mm-hmm. So we get to see how she feels about it. And for her, she feels like she can't do any time behind bars.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see where this plays out and what she eventually is, found guilty of. If she's found guilty of anything here, it just keeps getting weirder and darker, and you never know exactly where she's going to go. I would love to know. I would love to talk with someone about what life was like with Karen Reed, either as a colleague or a friend or whatever, because I'd like to know more about the pattern of behavior. It take it out to the context of this whole scene, and just, you know, was she like this in other scenarios where she can never be wrong? I'm going to guess that's what you'd probably have a lot of people saying about her. But I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but it would further solidify and really back up this pattern of behavior that she seems to be following to a T in all of this.
Right. Yeah. People don't typically change to a large degree if they're like that.
Yeah.
I will tell you that in speaking with people who knew her through John, but loosely, mm-hmm. you know, would see her at parties or things like that. They all said that initially they really liked her. Mm-hmm. One person told me a very interesting story. They said that, very personable, you know, funny, nice, mm-hmm. seemingly great. And that she had commented about her sweater and said, boy, I really liked your sweater. And that within days, that woman bought her a $400 sweater, just like Reed had. In other words, bought the woman. And this is something that you see with these people who literally have so many issues, is they buy or purchase mm-hmm. people's affection, and they get you, I call it like in Seinfeld, right? You get hand.
Yeah.
It gets hand over people.
Yeah. It's love bombing is what it is. And it doesn't always have to be in a romantic relationship type sense. It can be in a friendship sense like that, where I'm going to do grandiose gestures to really make you like me at first. And then once I've got you, then you start to see the true side of Karen Reed. And I think by 2 years, John O'Keefe was seeing it. And it was, you know, just the downhill from there. But I'm sure at the beginning it was lovely. And yeah, you're exactly right. That's interesting. That does show that pattern, that love bombing that these people do, because they can't maintain relationships for long term, because people eventually see through them. So they're always cycling through, and it just keeps going and going and going. And it seems that the only way that they know how to make true connections is by the grandiose gestures, because they lack empathy and they lack emotion and they lack the ability to understand other people's feelings. That's how narcissists typically act. I'm not saying she is, but again, she's following the playbook. And that explains that sort of behavior. And it explains all of this when you look at how this all started and where we are today. It's spooky. Well, we have a lot more to see in the trial of Karen Reed, and I'm sure we'll have a lot more to discuss next week on all of this. Jennifer Coffendaffer, thank you so much. Retired FBI special agent. Always good to get your insight on the world of Karen Reed.
Thank you, Tony.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
Well, they said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break Podcast, a real conversation about finance.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone.
I feel like sometimes being broke is a cycle and that we might have to revisit that.
And we're not stopping at success stories.
What happens when it doesn't go right? How do you cope with it?
Because wealth isn't just about money. It's about creating a life where you thrive and help others do the same.
Listen to the Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to The Wealth Break.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone. It's not just about saving. It's about investing. It's about navigating systems that weren't built for you, embracing your hustle, and relying on your community to create something bigger.
And that's exactly why we created The Wealth Break. We made something different, something more human. It's not just another financial podcast. It's a conversation about real life, real struggles, and real wins.
We're here to talk about the journey. You're here from people who've broken barriers, found creative ways to succeed, and learned to build wealth on their terms. Whether it's the first-time homeowner, a gig worker, or someone turning a side hustle into a six-figure business, we're bringing you their stories.
And we're not stopping at success stories. We're breaking down the realities, like what it means to take risk, how to navigate failure, and why resilience matters. Because wealth isn't about money. It's about creating a life where you can thrive and help others to do the same.
So if you're ready for a podcast as much as about people as it is about money, you're in the right place.
Listen to The Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break Podcast, a real conversation about finance.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone.
I feel like sometimes being broke is a cycle and that we might have to revisit that.
And we're not stopping at success stories.
What happens when it doesn't go right? How do you cope with it?
Because wealth isn't just about money. It's about creating a life where you thrive and help others do the same.
Listen to the Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone. It's not just about saving. It's about investing. It's about navigating systems that weren't built for you, embracing your hustle, and relying on your community to create something bigger.
And that's exactly why we created The Wealth Break. We made something different, something more human. It's not just another financial podcast. It's a conversation about real life, real struggles, and real wins.
We're here to talk about the journey. You're hearing from people who've broken barriers, found creative ways to succeed, and learned to build wealth on their terms. Whether it's the first-time homeowner, a gig worker, or someone turning a side hustle into a six-figure business, we're bringing you their stories.
And we're not stopping at success stories. We're breaking down the realities, like what it means to take risk, how to navigate failure, and why resilience matters. Because wealth isn't about money. It's about creating a life where you can thrive and help others to do the same.
So if you're ready for a podcast as much as about people as it is about money, you're in the right place.
Listen to the Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break Podcast, a real conversation about finance.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone.
I feel like sometimes being broke is a cycle and that we might have to revisit that.
And we're not stopping at success stories.
What happens when it doesn't go right? How do you cope with it?
Because wealth isn't just about money. It's about creating a life where you thrive and help others do the same.
Listen to the Wealth Break podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break Podcast, a real conversation about finance.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone.
I feel like sometimes being broke is a cycle and that we might have to revisit that.
And we're not stopping at success stories.
What happens when it doesn't go right? How do you cope with it?
Because wealth isn't just about money. It's about creating a life where you thrive and help others do the same.
Listen to the Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break Podcast, a real conversation about finance.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone.
I feel like sometimes being broke is a cycle and that we might have to revisit that.
And we're not stopping at success stories.
What happens when it doesn't go right? How do you cope with it?
Because wealth isn't just about money. It's about creating a life where you thrive and help others do the same.
Listen to the Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.